This week we're introducing a new book called Origins of the Gods with authors Andrew Collin and Greg Little. This week we're speaking with Andrew, who talks about new discoveries in light and consciousness. This is a study that has been going on for hundreds of years on light plasma, how light plasma is linked to geomagnetic fields that's causing all kinds of strangeness, including the strange phenomenon at Skinwalker Ranch in Utah, United States. The Tibetan skies, Tibetan and Chinese mountains, the unusual people that live in these areas, and their links to early hominins or Homo sapiens that are spread around the world. This is becoming more of a fact that it's not just Africa that these Homo sapiens are coming out of. They're coming out of China, Tibet, Australia, and many, many other places. Andrew's going to give us the details of this phenomenon, of these discoveries, in part one of Origins of the Gods. All this and more on Earth Ancients. Saturday, May 28th, 2022, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. It's been about 2 weeks now since I've returned from Egypt, and I've been in contact with a number of the group that was with us. What a fantastic group of people we had on this tour. Always a pleasure. And what I love about the Earth Ancients tours is we have people from around the planet who come together and join me and our host, whoever it is, wherever part of the world it is, to explore concepts that are presented on Earth Ancients. It's a chance to discuss these theories with the host and with everybody who's on the tour. One of the interesting aspects of this Egypt tour was our visit to the museum. Now, we had hoped that the Grand Egyptian Museum would be open. There's a real political stalemate going on. A lot of real weird thinking in terms of the reasons why it's been delayed multiple times. It was supposed to have been opened a few years ago, and I had a chance to speak with a number of authorities from the Antiquities Department. Nobody really knows when this thing is going to be open, which really makes me wonder what the issue is. Why is this massive museum being delayed? You know, is it corruption? Is it someone not being paid off? Is it not truly ready? You would think for a country like Egypt, who is spending upwards nearly of $1 billion or more on this museum, that they would open part of it, you know, open a portion of it, just to get people in there. So we don't know. It's hopefully going to be open before our next tour, which is in May of 2023, but we're not sure. Anyhow, we had a chance to go to the main museum, which is still open in downtown Cairo. And they had quite a few exceptional pieces that were still there. Nothing close to what the Grand Egyptian Museum has, because a lot of the material from the old museum has been taken and shipped off to that new museum. But one of the spectacular artifacts that was left to view was the death mask of King Tutankhamun. And when you see it up close and personal, it is fabulous. Just the ornate design, the reproduction of a human face in pure gold, the adornment of semi-precious stones, and just the craftsmanship is on just a different level. It was beautiful to see. The entire King Tutankhamun burial collection is now in the new Grand Egyptian Museum. So hopefully, like I said, next year we can see it. But the point of this mask being there was to show people just the level of craftsmanship and skill behind this mask. And by the way, you can see it on the Facebook Earth Angels page. You can go to the international or the local great regular group. And while I was observing it, one of our guests, Todd Harris from Australia, spoke of a story that he had heard about the gold on the mask coming from Australia, from Queensland, Australia, a place called Gympie, Australia, which is a mine on the outskirts of Queensland, Australia. So I looked around. I could not find an article or anything on this. In fact, I was a little dumbfounded because I was like, Jesus, I posted this and I told people that it was Queensland. Well, thankfully, and thank you, Todd, he sent me an article from an online magazine called Freedom Code. And there's a June 23rd, 2013 article called Ancient Egyptians in Australia. And it says, artifacts found in Tutankhamun's tomb point to a relationship with Australia long before today's archaeologists admit to a visitation. The death mask Tutankhamun was wearing has been analyzed, and it turns out it is made of Gympie gold. Gympie is a small town about 100 kilometers north of Brisbane, Australia. And the article goes on to say, because there is a myth and legend of a pyramid at Gympie that the government has tried to destroy for a number of years, the area has been hidden and no one really knows anything about it. The Gympie Pyramid is a terraced hill on the outskirts of Gympie in southeast Queensland. It purportedly has stone structures on it made of blue granite, built before modern European settlements. It has been shrouded in mystery and controversy ever since. Who built it? To this day, nobody really knows. There are many theories, from Phoenicians to the Spanish, so forth and so on. Here it is here. An in-depth look at all facets of this intriguing story are available on Brett Green's CDE book called The Gympie Pyramid Mysteries. So there you have it. I looked all through this, and I didn't see any detail, but apparently there's a group of geologists, archaeologists, and geophysicists that have purchased the property that this Gympie Pyramid is situated on. They purchased it in 2005, and that's about as far as it goes. I would love to have verification that the gold on the death mask of Tutankhamun does come from Australia, because there is a lot of mystery about the Egyptians, or early pre-dynastic Egyptians, settling in parts of Australia. In fact, there's an area that has hieroglyphs that are in dispute. Either they're fake or they're actual hieroglyphs. Hard to say. We have Stephen and Evan Strong on the show, who are in Sydney, and they claim that this has been verified, but we just don't know. But, you know, Todd mentioned this to me, and I was like, wow. And I had a great chance to see this death mask up close, really, really up close. In fact, I took a full photo, and the guard was yelling at people not to take photographs. And luckily, Todd squeezed one in there. And why they would not let people take photographs of this mask that has been photographed millions and millions of times is a real mystery to me. But anyhow, there you go. Gympie gold is the basis of this mask. What a real, real fascinating story. So, and like I said, that's the beauty of coming on a Earth Ancients tour. There's a lot of people with different opinions, different research, different data, and it really is a lot of fun to connect with people. So again, Todd Harris, I really appreciate that. By the way, Todd had his three sons with him, and they were great fun too. So glad that Australia can travel again, Australians can travel again, because there's a lot to see out there. I want to mention that the United States Congress is currently holding hearings. The House Intelligence Committee is holding the first public hearings on UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, in over 50 years. And this is a real eye-opener on a lot of different levels. First of all, something is making them do this. Either it's the public outcry, or it's about time these unidentified flying vehicles are becoming such a nuisance to the military, to the government, to perhaps even commercial airlines, that Congress, the United States Congress, is sitting in sessions with different experts from around the United States. This is the Space Command, this is NASA, and other governmental agencies that are basically giving them their best data. Now, we have to laugh a little bit when we hear about NASA, JPL, saying that they are going to look into it. Well, that's such a misnomer. It's ridiculous. They are the best agency to really tackle this, along with the Space Command, simply because the NASA JPL has been sending rockets and rovers to other planets for decades now. And it's funny because in this article I have here in the Daily News, NASA says they're going to check in with their astronauts. They're going to ask the astronauts, now, what do you know? What do you know? Which is just completely a joke, because their astronauts are forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. And we've had a few on the show on Earth Ages that have said, yes, we've seen things. Yes, other astronauts have reported that there are space vehicles shadowing their operations, shadowing their missions. And we all know what's happening on Mars. And for NASA to say, well, hey, we'll look into it, that's just being completely, I mean, they're making a complete farce out of this. They know a hell of a lot. I mean, look, we had Marion Rudnick on here. Here's a dedicated astronomer who worked with NASA for years. He retires, and then he has his own sighting, and they turn on him. They turn on this man. Rather than bringing him in and saying, what did you see? Give us the data. They sent out men in black, and to this day, they're still harassing him. Now, we're going to have Marion back this fall to talk about a second book on additional sightings that he's had. But, I mean, here is a academic, a NASA astronomer who's been treated like a pariah because he has come forth to talk about his UFO sightings. What does that mean for the other astronomers? For the other scientists that are having sightings, one of the aspects of the Black Knight Satellite book that I'm about to finish is that when they detected this vehicle orbiting our planet, they got a number of well-known astronomers who, by the way, each had a UFO sightings. That was the criteria to join the team to analyze the Black Knight satellite. They had to have a sighting or an experience of their own. And this is what really makes this book fascinating, the Black Knight satellite. This is a vehicle that comes out of a very early Earth period that is highlighted in the Mahabharata, also in the Rig Vedas, and a number of other Vedic texts describing a war for Earth. And we'll get into that later in the year as the book is about to be released. Something to check out. But getting back to NASA, it's a joke. They are a joke. And I have to just say this, that for them to come forward and play innocent. And by the way, Bill Nelson, who's the head of NASA, is disingenuous in his approach. He's playing ignorant. And these guys, these UFOs are shadowing the shuttle. They shadow the Apollo missions. They're all over the moon. We're seeing them on Mars, and here we are on Mars. Come on, we have ruins on Mars. Why are you sending up $2.5 billion probes to grab microbes, to grab bacteria, to see if there's any water on the planet. Is there any water on Mars? Uh-oh, wait, the rover bumped into a temple. Wait, don't look, turn. Get rid of that photo. It's just a joke. And I've said it many times. If the Chinese out NASA and show that the ruins have been there since the Viking missions, I hope they clear the table with these guys. I hope they remove their funding and reallocate money towards their projects. And I hope they clean house. I hope Bill Nelson loses his job as well as the others, because this is just it's a tragedy. We need to know that we're not alone. And being adherent to the Brookings Institute that was written in 1960, that's a joke. That's generations ago. People are different. People are open. It's just our government. Our government is the United States government is antiquated, is old, out of touch. These are men and women in their 70s, 80s, approaching 90. They're crotchety. They just don't get it. And this is the problems we have in the United States. We have a failed political system. Okay, anyhow, I'm not going to get into that because I'll get in trouble. All right, so there you go. NASA's telling us what it's all about. Check it out. You can see it in most, do a search in for NASA giving their 2 cents to the House Intelligence Committee. It's going to be funny to hear what the results are of this collection of senators. You know, it'll be like, will it be like, okay, well, they're here and we're studying them. Okay, goodbye. Or wouldn't it be nice for them to allocate some money to people like A.V. Loeb or other independent astronomers or organizations that are transparent? The problem with that is if you get involved with the United States Space Command, you will not be allowed to reveal anything. Even if they were to land on your front yard, come out and say, hey, we're here, you would not be able to talk about it, release data. You would be squelched with your life threatened. So we got to stop this, people. We have got to stop this. You know, it's getting out of hand. So anyhow, that's a little bit of local news. All right. Today, my guest is Andrew Collins. There's a new book that he, Andrew and Greg Little, wrote called Origins of the Gods, Chasm Cave, Skinwalker, and Contacts with Transdimensional Intelligences. We are going to take it in two parts. Today is Andrew, who will talk about his portion of the book. In a couple of weeks, it'll be Greg Little talking about his portion of the book. So had a really good talk with him. Fascinating book. Just came out. And it's going to be one for the book. So our program today is Origins of the Gods with Andrew Collins. Welcoming back Andrew Collins, and Andrew is a co-author of a new book called Origins of the Gods, and this book is a real eye-opener on a number of levels. Both Andrew and Greg capture a lot of material, a lot of fresh material, which is always fun to read. We're not rehashing a lot, and we have Andrew on with us today. We're going to have Greg on in the future to speak about the contents of this book. They both have spent a tremendous amount of time on this book. And I got to say, I had a lot of real great pleasure reading portions of the book simply because there's a lot of new material, new work on hominins that Andrew has done in Israel. We're going to talk about that today. I will mention that Greg will be with us, like I just said, and Greg is speaking on a whole other level of consciousness and otherworldly beings that is also tied in together. Together, like I was just saying, both Andrew and Greg pull a thought form together and create this book, Origins of the Gods. But hey, Andrew, great to see you. How are you? Good to see you.
Hello, Greg. Yeah, it's great here in the UK. You know, trying to keep up with which book I'm dealing with at the moment. I mean, Origins of the Gods has just come out. And obviously, you know, something I'm incredibly pleased with, and Greg as well. But next month, I'm going to be announcing another book as well, which is coming out next May. But that's to do with Egypt. But wow. I'll keep that for a separate interview. And then I started work on a brand new book just a few days ago, which will be the follow-up of my book, From the Ashes of Angels, which came out in 1996, a book that's been pretty controversial and very successful over the years.
Great.
And of course, it was the precursor for the discovery of Göbekli Tepe and everything to do with that, that confirmed a lot of what I wrote in From the Ashes of Angels.
Wonderful.
And I want to capitalize on that with the discovery of this place, Karahan Tepe, now, you know, which is the sister site of Göbekli Tepe. So I'm writing about that now. But we're talking about Origins of the Gods, and that is about skinwalkers. It's about transdimensional intelligences, communication with them, and their impact on human civilization, human technology, and human evolution, right since the beginning. Because, you know, we all know about, you know, UFOs, we know about aliens, and, you know, they've been around for a long time. But I personally, and Greg as well, think there's something else going on in the background, something that's possibly even older, that we could well be dealing with an impact from transdimensional intelligences, what we call n-dimensional beings, the n standing for number, as in the number of dimensions involved. We don't know whether they're five-dimensional, 11-dimensional, or they could be 32 dimensions, but we're dealing with intelligences or beings that exist probably within some kind of realm that coexists with ours but is beyond normal space-time. Quantum physicists, string theorists refer to it as the bulk, and it's a multidimensional realm. And that we as a universe sit within this thing called the bulk. And there may well be other universes within this bulk as well that have their own laws of physics. And sometimes these different universes could even touch each other or possibly even overlay each other at times. And at such points, portals, doorways, gateways may be available to allow an interaction between these two different universes. And what we have discovered is that the mechanism, the matter, the stuff that allows these portals to exist is plasma. Plasma is the false state of matter. You know, we know about solids, we know about liquids, we know about gases. But beyond that is something called plasma. And what a lot of theoretical physicists are looking at today is whether plasma, which is behind everything from the light of the sun to, you know, the light from black holes, from white holes, neutron stars, it's, you know, that the it's lightning, it's the stuff that comes out of your television to so that you can see the pixels. It is radiant matter, radiant light, and it is created under certain circumstances, which we can probably go into, and it would seem to be the stuff that allows UFOs to manifest, you know, quite literally out of nowhere. And it also seems to act as a doorway, a gateway, a portal between the three dimensions of space and one of time that define our own physical reality and that which is outside of normal space-time. In other words, plasma becomes the medium through which these intelligences from a higher dimensional realm are able to interact with our own.
Yeah.
And I think that once you realize that, a lot of things start falling into place, everything from UFOs to cryptids to, you know, weird beings, light beings, even shadow people, you know, could well be existing on a higher dimensional frequency, a higher dimensional state. And under certain circumstances, they are able to interact with this world. And if that's the case, then how much impact have they been having on humanity all the way along? How much have we been aware of their existence? How much time have we spent to try and communicate with them, you know, to nurture that relationship between us and them? And is that something that's been lost? In other words, what we see and what we experience today is something we fail to really understand that the importance of, whereas I think the ancients were very much aware of the presence of these intelligences and beings and realized that they could benefit from them. I think they were also quite scared of them as well.
Yeah.
But that they knew that these beings could give them knowledge and wisdom that could advance their communities and make them pretty smart. You know, I think that's... Yeah. That's the main thrust of the book, basically.
Yeah, I want to get into Skinwalker Ranch in a minute, but you actually chronicle a number of researchers who began studying these lights, and you actually went to China and had your own experience of these lights. Talk a little bit about some of the early research in these mountainous areas where these light beings or light phenomenon was very present.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are obviously sacred or holy mountains all the way around the world that are associated with mysterious light phenomena. And one of the reasons why they appear at these locations is because the environment around them is ideal. Why is it ideal? Because the geology, the intense geology of these locations permits this certain environment. And what I mean by that is you've got things like tectonic plates, you know, the plates that make continents that come together, smash together. And although this might have happened many millions of years ago, the intense pressure that it caused back then creates fault lines. It creates what they call micro faults, micro plates and things like this, which are all shifting constantly. I mean, you know, if you looked at them, you wouldn't really be able to see them shifting, but they are shifting. And what happens is that they bend, fold, distort the minerals in the rocks. And as this happens, they release particles called electrons. And these electrons will rise up to the surface and create these environments, what they call electron bursts. This, in turn, creates an environment where plasma can come into existence. Plasma, essentially, you know, if you want to put it into simple terms, is just electrons that have become very excited and are held together within like these self-generated electromagnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And as they get excited, they release photons of light, which are packets or particles of light. And suddenly it's like a light bulb suddenly switching on. And, you know, you have an object of light in front of you. Now, this could be something really small, like a small ball of light. It could be a huge, great, you know, oval or disc of light. It could be multiple lights together. It could be what we call electronic fogs or fire fogs, as they're called in Britain. And, you know, that seem to be luminous in nature. And getting too close to these will not only affect you electromagnetically, but it will send you into an altered state of consciousness, and the interaction between you and this phenomena can become complete. And I think that under such circumstances, you can quite literally be taken out of normal space time and taken into a multidimensional environment, something I refer to as a bubble universe, for a temporary period. And there you'll be able to communicate and connect with the intelligences, the beings involved with these plasma environments, which are truly alien in the sense that we don't really understand them, but not necessarily alien in the sense that they are flesh and blood beings from, you know, another planet. But what I think is that they are multidimensional in nature, and that this is the times that we do and are able to connect with them. And then what happens is you get thrown out of this temporary environment, these bubble universes. Mm-hmm. And when you hit the ground afterwards, you know, you'll find that hours, days, months, you know, sometimes according to old folklore accounts of these types of encounters, even years have passed. And I think this is the explanation for some, not all, some abduction, you know, UFO abductions. But the thing is that this phenomena has been around for thousands of years, and I think almost certainly millions of years, because what allows it to occur is these particular types of environments that allow the manifestation of UFOs to take place. I mean, since the 1950s, UFO researchers realized that there were certain locations where, you know, flying saucers, as they were known back then, or UFOs would appear more frequently than anywhere else. I mean, it was also realized that this may have some connection with geomagnetic fields. You know, in other words, mm-hmm. the natural fields that are generated by the Earth itself. And, you know, obviously we can monitor and register on the ground or from the air. And that there was a relationship between the appearance of UFOs and these, you know, particular type of nodes, if you like, on the landscape created by geomagnetic forces. I mean, Amy Michelle, UFO, was it Flying Saucers and the Straight Line Mystery? I think that was one of the first ones that came out in the 50s. You know, then you had people like John Michelle in the 60s looking at similar ideas with his book, The Flying Saucer Vision. But then it really took off in the 1970s with a book that was published in 1977 by a guy called Michael Persinger, who was a Canadian bioscientist. Mm-hmm. And a colleague of his wrote a book called Space-Time Transients and Other Unusual Phenomena. And it wasn't really a big hit, and it wasn't a pulp paperback, so it wasn't read like many other UFO books at the time. But it really set out the grounds to show that there was a relationship between everything from paranormal phenomena to geology of the Earth, to the manifestation of UFOs, to the appearance of cryptids, or what we call today cryptids, and other unusual phenomena. And these ideas were run with in 1982 by a Earth Mysteries writer and researcher by the name of Paul Devereux. He wrote a series of books like Earthlights, Earthlights Revelations, and also a book called Places of Power. And these really brought together the relationship, not just between UFOs and places of intense geology, you know, involving fault lines, tectonic plates, certain types of minerals such as quartz and tourmaline, which produce these electrons, but also certain types of metal ores like copper and iron all seem to be really important at locations where UFOs are seen on a regular basis. And, you know, in other words, these are your portal locations. I mean, you know, we know the term portal today, and we associate it with a place where you would see aliens, you would see cryptids, you would see UFOs. But the reason why it's called a portal, on the, you know, in other words, that the purpose, that the reason why it has become that, is because of the geology and the environment there. And therefore, it is these types of locations that become the most obvious place that you can make contact with these n-dimensional beings, or n-beings as we refer to, you know, these mm-hmm. trans-dimensional intelligences. Mm-hmm. They're there. And I think that they've been affecting humankind for, you know, probably millions of years, you know, ever since we arose from the African Rift Valley a couple of million years ago, and started to create fire for the first time, created the first multifaceted stone hand axes, you know, which was a complete change in everything we did. And that, you know, we've been under observation since then. I mean, and I think that they have been helping us, nudging us in certain directions since that time. But of course, you know, obviously some listeners are going to say, well, hold on, what's this got to do with, you know, nuts and bolts flying saucers or disclosure or underground bases with, you know, aliens working with? And the ultimate answer is very little, in all honesty, you know, because if that is real, then it's something different to what we're talking about. We're talking
I want to clarify the light and plasma. It's your suggestion in your book, using these other researchers, that it's a possibility when these plasma bursts happen that they're actual portals, and this is allowing other worldly beings to pass through their perhaps dimension or light years away from us into Earth's atmosphere. And then this is, you know, it's a physics we don't understand, is what you're suggesting, right?
Well, no, actually, I think we do understand it. I mean, there is enough within science now for us to, certainly from a theoretical point of view, to say, look, you know, all of this is very strongly possible now. I mean, plasma, there are various theoretical physicists that talk about plasma having an extra dimension of space. So that would be four dimensions of space and one of time. And time as well, you know, we see time as running forward and only forward. But it would seem that from a higher dimensional point of view, time doesn't exist in the same way. You know, it's not running backwards and forwards. Well, it is, but we are able to access points of time that are outside of, you know, the here and now. In other words, any intelligence that is of a higher dimensional nature will also at the same time be in touch with the future and at the same time with the past.
Yeah.
You know, they're outside of the here and now space-time that we live in and abide by. So, you know, I mean, how many times when people have UFO encounters, you know, do they feel a connection with the phenomena that they're actually encountering? The phenomena seems to respond to them. It seems to move in accordance with their mind. Mm-hmm. It's like the two are entangled, that the mind of the witnesses seems to be entangled with the intelligence of the actual objects themselves. And, you know, and after the experience, people feel this connection still. And it's almost something that they cannot, you know, it cannot stop for years. And they strive to try and have another experience that's exactly the same. Now, why should that be? I mean, you know, if you were seeing a Boeing 747 for the first time, you know, crossing the sky, A, it wouldn't move, you know, if you started looking at it, you know, in other words, responding to your own, you know, thoughts and ideas, and B, it's not going to sort of, you know, give you feelings that it is an intelligent being. But many UFOs, when people do interact with them, do see them as sentient, intelligent beings. And it's my feeling, again, as controversial as this may seem, that many UFOs are intelligent beings in their own right. They are beings of light, beings of energy, beings of plasma, and that their nature is of a higher dimensional state. And I think that, you know, this is it. And there's too much interpretation of UFOs as mechanistic, you know, nuts and bolts spacecraft. And I think that we need to disseminate in what we are seeing, you know. Okay. And the other problem is that people look at YouTube videos and say, look at this object, you know, look at it flying away, and oh, look, that one's got nuts and bolts in it, whatever. And the problem is, and people don't seem to understand, that the vast majority of those videos that you see on YouTube are hoaxes and fakes. I mean, there's no question about that. They're CGI. They're done deliberately to fool people. You know, people don't seem to understand that. I mean, having said that, among them are some incredible ones. I mean, some extraordinary videos are now coming out.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, you have to use your discretion, really. Mm-hmm. If something looks too good to be true, it probably is a fake, in all honesty. Yeah.
Let me ask you something. You hint on in this book of these, I'm just going to call them portals. You know, we got Skinwalker, we got places in Tibet, we got places in China. These portals, we're beginning to really identify. I mean, Skinwalker is such a weird and phenomenon-filled area. It looks like it could be a portal. Do we have an idea of other places? I had a NASA astronomer here, a guy named Marion Rudnick, who wrote a book about his encounters with aliens. He believes that a part of LA mountainside is a portal. They continually see craft appearing in this area. Is this your belief that there are designated areas, or is this a flux phenomenon where it moves and changes? Well,
look, I mean, you know, Skinwalker Ranch is the showcase portal in the world at this moment. I mean, it's got a whole TV show. And there are countless other portal locations, probably in every country of the world. I mean, you know, Skinwalker Ranch has become notorious. Many others haven't become so popular. And there are many mountains that are portals. Those mountains have become places where whole religions have started up, with temples and structures. You've got places, obviously, in North America, mountains like the Blanco Peak in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, which also, I would say, is a portal location. And I mean, you've got loads of them. And obviously, I live in the UK. I mean, Rendlesham Forest, where you had the famous Rendlesham incident in 1980. That's another portal. Mm. Bempton in the north of England, in the county of Yorkshire. That's the biggest portal at the moment in the UK. And they call that the British Skinwalker Ranch.
Is that because there's a lot of the sightings there, or light, well, or it's, light it's phenomenon?
It's exactly the same phenomenon as you get at Skinwalker Ranch. You know, you get, you know, weird beings being seen, lots of UFOs. Some of them look very flying saucer-like. Some of them are just lights. You get lots of different cryptids, from, you know, big cats to the what we call lycans, which is the correct term for dog men or dog-headed bipeds. You get, you know, weird electromagnetic anomalies, temporal distortions, you know, time anomalies, which have actually been, you know, properly recorded using an experiment by the lead investigator at Bempton, whose name is Paul Sinclair, who is a brilliant man and has done various books on what they call the Bempton phenomena. So that, you know, that these portal locations are all over the world, and all of them, I would say, have something in common, and that's the intense geology beneath them. Tectonic plates, fault lines, certain types of minerals, certain types of metal ores. I mean, not all together, but combinations of them. Mm-hmm. And they create the right electromagnetic environments for these UFOs to manifest within them, these plasma UFOs. And those types of plasma UFOs become like a gateway or a doorway, allowing not only these intelligences, but under the right circumstances, communion with other parallel worlds and parallel universes that probably allow a transfer of matter from one to the other. And that matter can probably include things like cryptids and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this can give us good explanation for a lot of the phenomena that takes place.
Let me ask you, do you believe that these entities, these beings that are in these craft, have been coming here for thousands, if not millions of years? And is there, in your estimation, in your research, is there a goal that they are here? Are they observing us? Are they influencing us in some way? I mean, we know that the native people, at least in the United States, the Hopi, the other groups, have had actual contact with star people, and talk about them and their lore. The anthropologists rarely talk about them. But what is your belief on that?
Well, I mean, firstly, yes, of course, you know, the Hopi and various other you know, Native American tribes, as well as, you know, indigenous peoples in many different parts of the world, particularly in the Pacific, have very strong traditions about sky beings coming down, often in objects. Sometimes they, you know, cohabit with mortal people and create whole dynasties, you know, that remain in charge of a particular region thereafter. And then, I mean, some of the accounts say these sky beings go back to where they came from, back into the sky. So we cannot deny that. And also, Carl Sagan, you know, one of the greatest cosmologists and astronomer, worked with NASA for many years. I mean, in 1963, he wrote a paper which, you know, has only recently resurfaced, basically concluding that the Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials thousands of times, you know, in the course of humanity.
Yeah.
And, you know, he even suggested looking in the Sumerian ancient texts for evidence of these visitations. Now, if he came to that conclusion back in 1963, I think that we should take this subject very seriously. And, you know, therefore, we probably have been visited on numerous occasions, you know, by extraterrestrials. However, if that's the case, that's something slightly different to what we're talking about here, because we're talking about transdimensional intelligences that coexist with us, that are outside of normal space time, but that can interact with us, probably not just through, you know, plasma, UFOs, encounters like that, but also through altered states of consciousness, shamanism, and, you know, achieving otherworldly knowledge and information in this way. And obviously one place I talk about greatly in the book is the Kesem Cave in Israel, which is just outside of modern day Tel Aviv. And this was discovered in the year 2000, and excavations have gone on since then through to the present day. And the archaeologists there have made some extraordinary discoveries, and these include the earliest evidence anywhere in the world of shamanism, in the form of this swan wing bone. And the wings are very, very important for shamanism because they give flight to the bird. So those were the most prized bones that were used by shamans in the past. And this swan wing bone, which is the only swan bone found in the whole of the cave amongst thousands of other bones that were, you know, discarded from food and stuff like this, was very clearly, you know, the feathers were taken away from it. It was modified, you know, in other words, made ready for use. And at the end of its time, it was placed in what we describe as the Holy of Holies within the cave, you know, a special place where they put their special stuff. And it would seem as if the people in the Kesem Cave were getting into altered states, using this bone and almost certainly other paraphernalia as well, to go on otherworldly flights into a parallel world, which they believed existed, probably had the ancestors, not only of themselves present, but also the ancestors of animals. You know, animals that they killed in the hunt would have been incredibly important to these people. And I mean, this is what the archaeologists working at the site say. And the evidence is one of the things that they were trying to do is get into this other world environment to communicate with their own perceived ancestors or precursors, and also the animals, the spirits of the animals that they'd killed. And from them, they would gain all this information and knowledge. And what's interesting is that at the same time that these people were writing the book on shamanism, they were also becoming the smartest people on the planet. You know, they were making a whole load of discoveries first for humanity. I mean, they created the first canned food, term used by the press.
Yeah.
You know, and basically what this was is that they would chop the legs off a newly killed deer, and they would wrap it in such a way as to be able to preserve the valuable marrow inside the bone so that they could chuck it in their backpack. And, you know, they could go off on you know, their hunts for, you know, several weeks, and then just get them out, you know, unwrap them, you know, break off the bone and just have a ready meal.
Yeah.
So the first canned food, that they were the first people to freeze fry food as well. They would you know, do this using ash. They were the first people to have production lines of stone tools called blades. They were the first people to have a school of rock. I mean, I'm only using terms that are in the press here, which was basically pupils would come to the cave and they would sit in different areas of the cave designated over for teaching practices, and they would learn the skills of making these beautiful stone tools. And I mean, it goes on and on and on.
We're going to take a short break from our discussion with Andrew Collins, and we will be right back. My guest today is Andrew Collins, who, together with his co-author, Greg Little, have written a new book called Origins of the Gods. This is a detailed look at unusual Earth phenomenon created by geomagnetic fields and also unusual Homo sapien-like creatures found in Israel. Yeah, I want you to talk a little more about this chasm discovery, because this is a new hominin that you write about, and you're saying that it's a branch of Homo sapien.
Yes, it
is. Which is pretty significant, yeah. Because it's not an ape-like creature. It's a very modern in many, many ways. How much of a skeleton do we have of these chasm?
Well, sadly, the actual chasm cave people itself, we've only got their teeth. There is some skulls found nearby, or some fragments of skulls, which seem to be part of the same population, but they seem to have mixed, because they're from a slightly later date, mixed with the local Neanderthal, so that they're not quite the same. But what we can say about the teeth of the Chasm cave people is that they are essentially identical to modern humans, to Homo sapiens.
Yeah, so, and that's important.
We're not dealing here with Denisovans, who are distant cousins of ours who were very important to the development of civilization, or Neanderthals, or Homo erectus, who had died out in that region by this time. You know, we're dealing with our own ancestors, our own direct ancestors, and they were making all of these firsts for humanity at the same time that they were inventing shamanism as well. And their first totem that they would seem to have used was the swan. I mean, as many readers of my books will know, I've had a particular interest in swan shamanism, and the area of the sky designated as the constellation of the swan, which is Cygnus, various of my books. Because it was very important and very, very ancient, going all the way back to Paleolithic times. And here's even more evidence that the swan was incredibly important to the very earliest shamans of this world.
Yeah, give us some dates. I think you said 400,000 years ago. It's just very, very, very deep in the past.
Yeah, it's 400,000 down to about 200,000.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that they were the first people to have hearths, in a cave, which was specifically used again and again for, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years, exactly the same position. And the importance about this is that you start to think about psychoactive substances. Mm-hmm. Because once you invent fire, you get plants that you think are going to burn, and you're going to chuck them on a fire, and it's going to keep your fire going. But amongst the plants you're going to be putting on occasionally are going to be psychoactive plants that, when they're burnt, they're going to start affecting you know, human consciousness.
Right.
And this is going to start shifting the way that you see the world, you start thinking about the world. And it's going to take a while, but eventually you'll start to realize which plants are doing this and are having this effect on, you know, the human bodily systems, on the mind. And you're going to start enhancing that, and you're going to start using that for achieving altered states of consciousness and communicating with these otherworldly beings. And I don't know specifically whether drugs were being used in the Kesem cave, because unfortunately not enough work has been done to do with the seeds, the pollen and whatever else that's been found in the cave as yet. I don't think it really matters, because we've got the shamanism there present anyway. And as we know, there are many different ways to alter into an altered state of consciousness.
Let me stop you right there. Was there any wall paintings found on this cave? Because I know you had a chance to go in a part of the cave.
Yeah.
Just curious. There's nothing on the wall.
I'll tell you for why. Because the cave was discovered when they were building a new highway from Tel Aviv to the, well, essentially the Palestinian West Bank, the Nablus area. And so they were cutting through, you know, these cliff faces and rocky outcrops and whatever, making this new highway. It's called the Trans-Sumerian Highway. And they blasted one particular piece of rock and suddenly realized that strewn around everywhere were all these bones and stone tools. So they realized that this was a prehistoric occupation site. So they called in the archaeologists and said, you have to now put in a bid so that you have the right to now excavate this. And the team that puts in the lowest bid is the one that wins it. Not the highest bid, the lowest bid, because the lowest bid is going to cost the company, the construction company, the least to allow these people to come on and do the excavation. In other words, the construction company are responsible for paying these archaeologists to excavate their site.
I like how you wrote about that, how the government makes these construction companies, they have to have some money set aside for the inevitable discovery of a ruin or a... I hear what you're saying about that. Yeah. So anyway,
the guys from Tel Aviv University, particularly Ram Bakai and Avi Gofer, who are two very famous Israeli archaeologists, got the contract. So they began work there in, I think it was 2001 or 2002, and worked all the way through to 2016. But they gathered so much material. After that, they had to put down their tools and stop for a while, because, I mean, the biggest problem you've got with the cave is if you go there, it doesn't look like a cave at all. I mean, it's just a series of, like terrace steps now where they've obviously been excavating. The roof of it's gone completely and the walls, because it was blasted out, I'm afraid, doesn't exist anymore. And that rock would have been carried away by the construction company before they realized what was going on. But they are still burrowing down into the deeper part of the cave. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go down there with Ram Bakai. And, I mean, whilst we were down there, we had an incredible conversation about swan shamanism, its importance, and where all this was going and what they expected to find. I've actually got this as a video, and I will put it out there, providing Ron's okay with it. Ran is okay with it. I think I'm going to put that out there in the next couple of weeks, because it's an extraordinary conversation. And this is a mainstream archaeologist. This is not a fringe guy, but he's one of us. He thinks the same way that we do.
Yeah, he's very much into shamanism too, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And I mean, he recently co-authored a paper with a couple of other, I think they were, postgrads who were working at Tel Aviv University, but I might get this wrong, but about how hypoxia could create altered states of consciousness and may have inspired early Paleolithic artists to create rock art and stuff like this and achieve, advances in shamanism. And hypoxia, of course, is something which you get if you spend far too much time in caves, and you start running out of oxygen and start breathing carbon dioxide again. And, you know, it starts affecting the brain. Of course, it can ultimately kill you, ultimately. But there is a possibility that if utilized in a regular fashion, that it could be used to get into altered states of consciousness. So, you know, he did a paper on that recently. So, I mean, that's very forward thinking, and that got published all around the world. But he, as I say, his main focus is definitely the Kesem Cave, even though, of course, there are several other key sites in Israel at the moment that are also adding to this incredible story.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. You've been talking about Denificence for years, and unfortunately, we don't have a complete skeleton. But it's pretty prominent that these were unusual beings. You tend to make them out as fairly large hominins. We don't know exactly how big they were, but they're bigger than a normal Homo sapiens sapien. What is it, Andrew, about these different hominin groups? It seems like they are all over different parts of the world. It's like they were dropped there and given a chance to develop, and then some of them developed. Obviously, we're Homo sapiens sapien, but the Neanderthals and some of these early hominins didn't live very long. What do you think that's about? Is it? It's like someone actually had a big experimental lab called Earth.
Well, I mean, I think to say that they didn't live long is probably understating the case. I mean, I think the situation is that they evolve, and they evolve by interbreeding with other species or other human populations. I mean, it's like the Denisovans. What I say in the book, I do cover them in some detail, again, as I've done in the last two books before this, is that the Denisovans were in Africa. They probably left Africa something like about 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. And some of them would have gone through the Levant. In other words, the corridor that is today, you know, Israel, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and then from there, obviously, into the Near East, and then the Central Asia and onwards. Now, as they passed through the Levant, they would have encountered the Kesem people. The Kesem people are our ancestors. They are like proto Homo sapiens. And if the Denisovans encountered them, and I wrote a whole article about this and put it up on Ancient Origins in, I think, about 2019, that the chances are they would have interbred. And if they did, then those that continued the journey out of the Levant towards Central Asia would already have been hybrids. And this makes a lot of sense of the anatomical information that we have about the Denisovans in Siberia and Tibet, that they show certain archaic elements. In other words, quite similar to distant cousins like Homo erectus, for instance, you know, with these very, what they call, archaic features, we'll call them, you know, very heavy brow ridges,
right?
You know, no chin, you know, quite heavy cheek bones and the rest of it. But also they show very strong signs of modern Homo sapiens. And, you know, the teeth, structured jaws and various other things. And if that's the case, then the Denisovans in Siberia and places like the Denisov Cave were already hybrids. They were already hybrids of the Kesem people and the pure Denisovans that came out of Africa originally. So that's what I wrote in 2019. But as I was writing Origins of the Gods, obviously, you know, with Greg doing his half, information came out about a new skull that had been found just a few miles away from the Kesem Cave. It was slightly dated. I think it dates to about 200,000, so right at the end of the time of the Kesem Cave, that basically had great similarities to a skull that had also just been promoted and publicized that had been found in China, which is now known as the Dragon Man skull.
Yeah.
Now, the Dragon Man skull was found as early as the 1930s when the indigenous Chinese people were making a bridge across the local river there, at this city called Harbin. And they were under the control of the Japanese at this time. And they came across, as they were digging, you know, the holes to create this bridge, this skull. And the guy that found it hid it away in a well right the way through until, well, recent times. And he told, I think, a grandson or somebody in his family. They went and retrieved it. And it was perfectly preserved and has been studied by, you know, Chinese academics now, and have verified that it's, you know, at least 150,000, 160,000 years old. And they have decided that it's a brand new type of human being, one called Homo longi, which basically means dragon man, basically. But everybody else in every other part of the world has looked at it and said, that's the Denisovan. You know, from the teeth, everything we know about the Denisovans, the jaw, which is very similar to a Denisovan jaw that's been found in Tibet, everything we know about the thickness of the skull, what we know about brow ridges, everything, everybody else has said, that's a Denisovan skull. And the Chinese say, no, it's not. No, this is unique. And the trouble is that there is a certain amount of nationalism goes on in China, as we obviously know and realize, that they want to be the ones that discover it and that everything started.
And they're calling it China. They're calling it the Dragon People, right?
Yeah, well, it's the exactly, Dragon People, and I mean that's quite extraordinary, as I write in the book, because there is traditions in the very same area of Harbin of what they call this black dragon, basically, and when you see the accounts, it's almost like a sort of cross between a human and a primate. And, you know, there are legends to do with this. And I've said, is it possible that this black dragon is itself a memory of the presence of Denisovans in this region in the distant past? And that these stories and legends have been passed down for, you know, not just tens of thousands, but arguably even hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah, I mean, I think that is possible. Now, this story that I'm telling you now is all in the book. It's in some ways in excess to the main theme of the book, but I felt I had to put it in there for completion. So, you know, the role that the Denisovans played is something that's so powerful today that you cannot really ignore it in any book.
Yeah, fascinating. The book's called Origins of the Gods. My guest is Andrew Collins, whose co-author is Gregory Little. We'll have Greg on in a couple of weeks to talk about his contribution. As we conclude, Andrew, what is unique about Skinwalker Ranch? I know there's a TV program. I don't really watch that program, but there's not only aerial light phenomenon, there are what you call sentient light, or sentient means self-aware or conscious light beings.
Yeah.
But more than that, I think there's been reports of strange creatures that appear. Talk a little bit about the fascination of Skinwalker and maybe a little history. Do we have a historic background on that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something I looked into in great. I mean, during the writing of this book, I had the privilege of being able to go to Skinwalker Ranch and spend a couple of days there. I spent time with, you know, all the main players of the TV show. But I was also able, you know, to talk to them about what their views were. But also I was able to talk to workers on the ranch, you know, people that were just working. They had no real interest in UFOs. And yet they, you know, also had their own sightings, many of them. And they, you know, they would see objects either very high in the sky suddenly manifest, or they would see what would appear like balls of light just going along this thing called the Northern Mesa, which is on the northern edge of the ranch. Mm-hmm. And some of them had seen more than one. I mean, you know, so this is not something that was only being seen by a select few. I mean, anybody that could go on that ranch and experience it. And I mean, for me, it felt very eerie being there. And I mean, I say this because there's only a few places I've ever been to that I felt something strange about the place. And, you know, one of them was Marfa in Texas, where which is another place where mysterious lights appear. Another is Bempton in the north of England, which is, as I say, this British Skinwalker Ranch. But the other is obviously Skinwalker Ranch itself. And I kept saying to myself, you know, I feel like I'm on, you know, on the edge of paradise here. You know, it's like a paradise where anything can manifest at any time. And, you know, I mean, I couldn't really justify that with any evidence other than the fact that I was, the whole time I was there, I was taking pictures constantly. I was doing video footage. I was recording stuff audibly because I wanted to take it all away and get my engineer friend, Rodney Hale, to check the lot, everything, every frame, every piece of footage, every sound recording to see what we had. And not only were we able to record a strange burst of very low frequency sound actually on that northern mesa, but the main place that seems to be haunted, I use that word loosely, is what they call Homestead 2, which is a sort of remote ruin now on the ranch. And I was taking pictures towards it from the field nearby. And on one of the pictures, this strange object appears. And it looks like a creature. It looks like a bird, but it has yellow in it, blue, black, a little bit of white. It has something strange hanging from it that almost looks like a stalk of wheat. And it's quite sharp, so that means it's not close to the camera. And I've asked all sorts of people what they think it is. And it's very clearly in the vicinity of Homestead 2, almost as if it's directly over the top of it. And, you know, I've asked, is it an insect? No, it's too clear. It's, you know, it's definitely not any insect that anybody's ever seen. Is it a bird? I've talked to experts in Utah, you know, that know every type of bird. Nobody was able to recognize it at all. It's not a drone. Somebody suggested it could be a drone. There was no drone up at that time, although there was one later on, but it didn't look anything like that. So is it a cryptid? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I show the picture in the book, and it is a very, very strange photograph. So
yeah, I'm looking at the book right now. I'm trying to find that. You have a couple of pictures of some strange things that you took, strange images. What's the native bat? What does the native say about Skinwalker? Is it
right? This is a very interesting story because the term Skinwalker means the supernatural form that a Navajo witch takes when they're in an altered state of consciousness during ceremonies and rituals.
Right.
And those rituals would often be done to curse enemies. The most likely form a Navajo witch, and I use that term lightly, I mean, you know, we might as well use the term shaman. The most likely form that they're going to take is a wolf. And in fact, the word in Navajo for wolf and witch is more or less identical. I mean, it's the same word. So, you know, that's why skinwalkers are most obviously associated with wolves. And the reason why that's important is that we know that oversized wolves have been seen in and around Skinwalker Ranch when wolves themselves are not indigenous to that region at all, which is itself peculiar. But obviously there are these dogmen, these lycans, which is the correct archaeological term when these dogmen creatures are seen in rock art, for instance. They're called lycans. And they are seen and have been seen on many occasions, not many, but on various occasions at Skinwalker Ranch. And of course, as you say, we've got stories of lights and stuff like this. Well, the thing is that the Utes and the Navajo, who are the two main tribes of the region, hated each other, particularly in the 19th century. there were various tribal wars, some of them involving the Mormons who had settled in this area of Utah, obviously. And the Utes even imprisoned and sold as slaves the Navajo. And, I mean, obviously, after the wars, it's possible that the Ute felt some kind of guilt over this. I don't know. But what I do know is that the skinwalkers, as they refer to them, started appearing, in particular on the northern mesa, on the north side of Skinwalker Ranch, which they call the Path of the Skinwalker. And they interpreted this, rightly or wrongly, as evidence of the curse that was put upon them by the Navajo because of what they did.
Hmm.
Now, the ethics of this, I don't know. I mean, and, you know, and in a way, all we can say is this is what the Ute actually believe. But all of this really does tell us that the Ute were obviously seeing something, and that they were seeing this as much as 150 years ago. So, you know, we know that strange phenomena has been taking place at Skinwalker Ranch since that time. And it's not only Skinwalker Ranch where this phenomenon is occurring. There is another ranch just to the west of there, which I was going to talk about in the book, but I got cold feet over and I didn't, because I didn't have permission to use their name, where I know that similar phenomena is going past. In fact, some of their phenomena is even more weirder than that which is going on at Skinwalker Ranch. And indeed, that whole area of the Uintah Basin is having strange phenomena. So it's not unique. But here's the important thing. I went there thinking I need to find out why this place is so important. Why is it a portal? And I came away with the answer, because on the northern mesa is a fault line. It's on geological maps. I was given a copy of one by a geologist that happened to be there at the same time. And I followed this through. The US Geological Survey, you know, mapped it, recorded it. And although they only recorded part of it, it's quite clear that it probably does stretch along the entire length of the northern mesa and thus coincides perfectly with the Path of the Skinwalker, you know, the term that's actually used by the Utes even to this day. Plus, the rock itself is sandstone. That sandstone is full of quartz, and it powders. It powders to such a degree that you have to wear masks or scarves when you're doing work for prolonged periods of time on Skinwalker Ranch,
mm-hmm.
Because it's deadly, really. I mean, it's like really tiny shards of quartz that will go into your throat, you know, and obviously into your lungs as well. But this is the perfect ripe environment to produce electrons, electricity that creates the right environment that allows ionization to take place. This is the process that causes plasma to suddenly manifest into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And once plasma is present, it creates electromagnetic fields. And those are what affects the electrical instruments, people's smartphones, bodily systems, human mind, all the rest of it. Much of what you see on the TV show can be explained by the intense geology of the area and the phenomena that that geology will produce.
Fascinating. One last question before I let you go. I wondered, I had heard rumors that there were some kind of ET manifestations there too, unusual ships being seen there. Do you have any knowledge of any of that kind of sightings?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, definite beings, definite UFOs, definite what we would call structured craft. And what I mean by that is objects that have,
yeah,
you know, substance to them. I mean, there's no right. question about that at all. They may drop beams down and stuff like this. But here's the thing. They could be nuts and bolts spacecraft. But on the other hand, they could equally be transdimensional beings manifesting into our reality using this environment. And in other words, they themselves are the intelligences. These craft are intelligent beings in their own right.
Right.
And I think mm-hmm. that we need to look at that possibility. So that when in the future you know, you see a UFO in the sky, don't automatically assume that it's a mechanical spacecraft.
Yeah.
You know, look at the possibility that it's also an intelligent being in its own right.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are talking to me about UFO sightings right now. And the American government is, you know, rebranding the whole UFO phenomenon to unidentified aerial phenomenon.
Yeah.
Why would they do that? Perhaps your suggestion is in place. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's plasma. Maybe it's an ET form of craft that is not mechanical or nuts and bolts, as you call it. So there's something going on.
Well, look, I mean, if it was all simply nuts and bolts spacecraft and that they've been visiting us since 1947 and the Roswell crash, I think that we would have far more answers by now and that you would have got much more of a disclosure. But it's not there. And I do genuinely believe that governments, you know, the military, have some answers. But those answers, I think, are not enough for them to fully comprehend the nature of the phenomena that's with us and is present. And, I mean, we've all seen these, you know, incredible U.S. Navy videos that have been put out there and been verified to be genuine UFOs. But what are those UFOs? I mean, what are those craft, those structures?
Yeah.
You know, they are plasma. There's no question about that, in my opinion. But as I said, you know, whether they come from another planet or whether they come from a transdimensional realm known as the bulk, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Andrew, amazing as always, insightful. Give us your website, how people can get a hold of you. To get more information.
Yeah. Okay. My website is andrewcollins.com, all as it sounds. I'm on social media. All the links are on the opening page of the website. Coming up, there's a big event with Eric von Daniken, who wrote the foreword to the new book, Origins of the Gods, in Blackpool in the UK on June 24th to 26th.
Oh, that is coming up real soon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
got a lot of good people there.
Yeah, Giorgio's there. Many other of my colleagues, you know, from the subject and from television are there. And we're going out to Turkey if you want to join us in September, going to Göbekli Tepe, Karahan Tepe, and all the great sites out there. All the details are on my website, andrewcollins.com. Join me and Hugh Newman out there. And I'll be out in the States in September, going to Boulder, Colorado, for a big event with Gaia TV for the Ancient Civilizations TV show, which I do with them. But more information about that shortly. So
okay.
That's about it, really.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Let me just ask you, and our listening audience is always curious, what's happening in the UK and in the United States with the conferences? A lot of them took a beating and died out during the pandemic, but is it your sense that they're kind of revamping and kickstarting? Yeah.
Well, I mean, recently I went to the Megalithomania conference in Glastonbury, which is organized by Hugh Newman.
That's Hugh, yeah.
Yeah, I was a keynote speaker there, and it was sold out, completely sold out.
That's good.
The event in Blackpool already has 500 people signed up. So people want to go to this type of thing again. And, you know, that I think they realize just how important conferences are to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and how much it's not just about listening to the speakers, but, you know, the talk, you know, the conversations, who you meet, you know, just saying hi to people and, you know, having a drink in the pub afterwards and, you know, just hanging out. I mean, people so miss that they really want it again. And I think that provided, touch wood, that we don't have any other problems, next year, I think it will be probably the greatest year of conferences ever, I think.
That might be a good product prediction. So, hey, Andrew, much success on Origins of the Gods, and we'll look forward to seeing you again. Thanks for joining
Brilliant.
Me.
Brilliant. Thanks, Cliff. All the best.
The first part of the book is written by Greg Little, Origins of the Gods. And he tackles not only the light phenomenon, but very, very early explorers of the alien UFO, or now UAP question. And in some cases, he brings up a couple of different Europeans who have actual face-to-face contact, documented contact with otherworldly entities, beings. And this is fascinating to me, and I'm looking forward to him. He will be on the program Saturday, June 9th. This is not to be missed. This is research and documentation that I have not heard about. And I thought I knew everything about contact with aliens, physical contact. And this is a reported case that goes back to the 1700s. And how he found this is the questions we'll be asking, as well as the importance of contacting and working with beings from other planets. This is something that is very dear to my heart, because I think this may be going on now, but because of the implications for disclosure, and we're not talking about government disclosure, this is probably happening on an individual case-by-case situation. I mentioned before that there are cases in Mexico reported by the research investigator Jaime Masson of... the one case I know about is a physician was able to give a living being from another world a full physical and then reported his findings. And there's some other cases that have happened in South America. One individual who we'll talk about later in the year actually had sexual relations with a being, copulated with a being, and was awake, was not drugged or hypnotized or doped up in any manner. He was fully conscious when it happened. We'll talk about that at another time. But Greg is going to present a fascinating look at the whole UAP, UFO, alien interaction phenomenon. Also, the fact that, and this is what makes this book fascinating, is that the UFOs are not only physical, or as Andrew calls them, nuts and bolts, they are plasma ships. They are ships that are not metal or any exotic types of metals that we don't have on Earth. They are of a plasma base, and this is the basis of his portion of the book. So we'll see and hear from Greg June 9th, Saturday, June 9th. It's coming up. And I'm really looking forward to having him on the program. By the way, the book, Origins of the Gods, is available to those who are Patreon subscribers. You can get the ebook complete. You can download it. And that is the gift. For more information, go to patreon.com/Earth Ancients and become a subscriber. If you are a subscriber already, the book was up. It is a huge book. It's filled with colored photos and lots of black and white photos. They really did it right. So that's it for you. By the way, while I'm speaking about Patreon, we really need your support. It's really a challenge to put together three different podcasts. We're talking about Earth Ancients, Destiny, and then every month we put out a Earth Ancients special edition, the archives. And those are also quite a bit of work to re-edit and rework and place on the network. So we really appreciate it. $5, $10, $15, even $20 a month is really appreciated. And all you do is give them an ATM card. They just deduct it every month out of your card. You don't have to even think about it. And our gift to you for being a subscriber is many of these ebooks, and we're up to about 22 now that you can download from our authors. And these are our thank you gifts, as well as unpublished interviews, galleries. And occasionally I get on the horn and we talk about some of the current events that are discussed, either on Earth Ancients or Destiny or special edition, the archives. So please consider becoming a subscriber. For more information, go to Patreon. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N eon.com/earthancients. Hey, I want to thank the following people for subscribing recently. I want to thank James Wheatley, Ryan Kane, Will Angley, and Ramzan Buddha. You guys rock. I really appreciate you being subscribers. And hey, I hope you enjoy the gifts. Hey, we got an amazing tour coming up. Labor Day week. It's September 2nd through the 12th, 2022. This is our annual trip to Mexico. We've just added a speaker. Marco Vigato will be giving us a heads up on the scans he's been doing at in Oaxaca at a very ancient site, one of these megalithic sites that's pre-Aztec, pre-Maya. We're talking stonework that is in the multi-tons. He got permission. He's working with archaeologists from INAH and is going to give us the lowdown with photographs, as well as portions of his book that were not published. So this is part of this tour. Then we go to the new Aztec area that's been unearthed, as well as the museum in downtown Mexico City. Then we jump on a plane and go to La Venta, land of the Olmec. We are there for almost 2 days, and we see all the wonderful museum pieces that are there, as well as some of the archaeological parks. We get on a bus, head directly to southern Mexico. That is Palenque, and I haven't been to Palenque in over 10 years. It is really the jewel of the tour. We're going to be there for a couple of days to check out the pyramids. We'll climb many of the temples. We'll connect with the energies that are there and really manifest fantastic realities. From there, we get on another bus, and we head to Campeche, which is on the coast. That is the site of Edzna, one of the most beautiful Mayan sites in the world. We'll be there for a day. We spend the night in Campeche, and then we head north to Yucatan. And that is the Pook Trail. That's Sahil, Labna, the Grand Lady herself, the beautiful city of Uxmal with the Pyramid of the Magician. We spend some time in some cenotes, swimming in some cenotes. And then we conclude with a visit to Mayapan, where we climb the pyramids, and then the Grand Lady herself, Chichen Itza. So this is not a tour to miss. If you can make it, it is very reasonable. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. The entire itinerary is there. Get your deposit in. We're only taking about 20, maybe 25. I'm not sure yet. 20 at the most at this time. Again, for more information, earthancients.com/tours. Come out and join us. All right, that's it for this week. I want to thank my guest today, Andrew Collins, and the release of his new book, Origins of the Gods. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everybody who edits and makes everything happen. You guys rock! You really do. All right, take care, be well. Have a happy Memorial Day weekend, and we'll talk to you next time.